Good evening and welcome everyone to the April 19th, 2022 regular meeting of the Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency Board of Directors. With that, I have called the meeting to order and we can move on to a couple of announcements before we go to Pledge of Allegiance, by the way. We do have new microphones. We do have some directors who are sitting in front of the microphones for the first time. So let me go through a couple of comments. To use the microphone, please press down on the button on the right side of your microphone. When it turns green, it is on. Please hit the right button again to mute yourself. It will turn red. Make sure you unmute to speak and remute when you are done speaking. At each of your spots, there are directions on how to log in to the Zoom so that you are able to see the virtual attendees. Please follow the directions and make sure your audio is turned on, off. IT is here to help should you need assistance. We can now move on to the Pledge of Allegiance, and I would ask Director Bronstein if she would kindly stand and lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Director Bronstein. So for our announcements for tonight, this meeting is being conducted in person at the Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant Boardroom. As a convenience to the public, members of the public may also participate virtually by logging into the agency's Zoom meeting. Any member of the public may listen to the meeting or make comments to the board using the call-in number or Zoom webinar link. In the event there is a disruption of service, which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public using either the call-in option or internet-based service, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public and is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. As a reminder to the board members who are online and staff, please mute all of your devices until you are ready to speak. Make sure you unmute when speaking and remute when done speaking. All board members participating remotely, which I don't think we have any board members participating remotely, please turn on your cameras. Staff presenting remotely, which is possible, please turn on your camera while presenting and turn them off when your item is complete. Board members participating remotely, please use the raise hand feature in Zoom, requesting to speak. Members of the public may comment as to items within the subject matter jurisdiction of the agency that are not on the agenda during item three. Members of the public wishing to comment on items covered in this agenda may do so at the time each item is considered. To participate in public comment, from your computer, tablet, or smartphone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, click the raise hand feature in Zoom. You will be notified when it is your turn to speak. Please unmute when requested. To participate in public comment via phone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, dial *9 to raise your hand. Phone participants will be called upon by the last two digits of their phone number or by name. When it is your turn to speak, dial *6 to unmute. We do have public present tonight, so I'd like to remind the public that are attending in person that there are public comment cards on the table outside. Please complete and return to the board secretary to help expedite public comments. The procedures for tonight's meeting are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments. I will then ask for discussion and questions from board members. Please raise your hand, by the way. Once concluded, I will ask for a motion and a second. After any further discussion, the board secretary will call for votes. I don't think we're doing roll call tonight. Is that correct?
We are not. No roll call votes.
The next paragraph explains it. We are voting tonight by your microphones. When it is time to vote, your microphone screen will show you three options: yes, no, or abstain. Please select your vote by pressing the correct response or chosen response on your screen. Votes will be shown once all the directors have voted to exit the screen. Click the close button at the bottom of the screen. All directors are present for tonight's meeting, including Director Cooper, who managed to get here on time because he has a lot of influence with the airline coming back from Sacramento. Before we take public comment, at each of your spots, there are water efficiency kits. There are also some outside on the table for the public, so please help yourself. California once again is experiencing drought, and for us here in the Santa Cruz Valley, exceptional drought conditions persist. SCB Water recognizes the importance of conserving water wherever and whenever we can. Our conservation team has provided these residential water efficiency kits to help customers save water at home. Each water efficiency kit includes two automatic shutoff hose nozzles, one high-efficiency shower head, two high-efficiency bathroom aerators, one universal fitting toilet flapper, two toilet leak detection dye tablets, one drip gauge, one flow rate bag to measure pre and post volume rates and instructions. While we have some kits on hand for our guests tonight, SCB Water customers can pick up two free residential water efficiency kits at our customer care office at 24631 Avenue Rockefeller by signing up for our free drought ready checkup or upon emailing conservation@scbwa.org. Please visit our website at droughtreadyscb.com and learn how you can obtain your residential water efficiency kit, as well as other ways to save water during the drought. Mr. Matt Dickens, our water conservation expert, is here tonight if you have any questions. Matt, did you have anything that you wanted to add? I'm not even sure Matt is actually here.
He's virtual.
Oh, he's virtual. Okay, so Mr. Dickens, is there anything you wanted to add to the comments tonight? Hearing none, I guess Matt is happy with what we've said.
You know what? Let me move Matt over. He's got his hand up. Hold on. Let me move him over to a panelist.
All right.
And then that way because he's got his hand up.
So go ahead, Matt.
Thank you, President Martin and members of the committee. Can you hear me? I'm bored. Excuse me. Can you hear me? Great. Fantastic. Yes. Thank you for those sharing those remarks. And we definitely wanted to provide those water efficiency kits for your use. And there's also available to the public. Recently, I conducted a talk for the Rotary Club and members of the club really appreciated having access to those tools and resources to help them save water. And of course, during this drought, our conservation performance has been following weather, and as we get into the dry season, we are certainly encouraging customers to conserve water, as you said, sir, whenever and wherever we can. So with that, I encourage customers to contact us, visit our website to get more information, and we're ready and able and capable and looking forward to serving the community every way we can. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate that. With that, we can go to item 3, public comments. Members of the public may comment as to items within the subject matter jurisdiction of the agency that are not on the agenda at this time. Again, we ask that members of the public wishing to comment on items covered in this agenda do so at the time each item is considered. We do have one public comment that we received in writing, and I will read that in a moment. And we do have two comment cards for item 3 that we will call upon the members of the public who submitted the cards in just a moment. At that time, once we take care of the comments we've received in writing and the members that are in here to make comment, we will ask if there are any other members wishing to make public comment. So with that, I will read the one public comment we received earlier in the day It is from Cher Gilmore, and it's for public comment for April 19th Water Board meeting. Dear Water Board members, I understand that you will likely be approving a Stage 2 water shortage contingency plan and water supply shortage ordinance at your April 19th meeting. This is after deciding last month that there's enough water to supply the Castaic Lake Mountain apartments, over 1,000 new units. Please tell me how in the world that makes sense. We all know that with climate change, water shortages are only going to get worse. In fact, several articles I've read indicate that climate scientists believe we're in the worst drought in 1,200 years and that it won't end anytime soon. The latest IPCC report confirms that we have an existential problem that's getting worse each year and will continue to do so until we slash emissions radically, which so far is not happening. Given that fact, it is patently foolish to keep building new housing year after year when you're already in deep trouble over water. I don't know by what calculation you managed to decide there will be enough water in the future, but I believe you're basing the decision on wishful thinking, expecting best case weather scenarios instead of on what science is telling us. Mountain snowpack providing us about 30% of the yearly freshwater supply for California. And although there are years here and there when it's almost normal, the trend is for less and less snowpack. And that pattern is expected to continue as long as climate change proceeds unabated. All of our reservoirs are at dangerous, historically low levels too, though some gained a little water from last year's rains. We usually get some of our local water from the state, but the state can't give us water that it doesn't have to give. And that depends on the snowpack. Was it last year that we got a zero allotment? Also, almost half of our local wells have been shut down because of PFAS chemical contamination. So even our groundwater use, which provides about 40% of our water, is threatened. Until that situation can be fixed, we have some reserves due to water banking, but only a two-year supply. Overall, the situation is grim, but unbelievably, it isn't being treated like a crisis. I realize money is involved for the city in the form of taxes, and developers are no doubt putting money and influence behind all elected officials who will continue to allow them to build high-end housing. That scenario enriches them. But what about the people who live here? Public welfare / the common good is rarely the priority when money is involved. And it appears to me that you, our public servants, are gambling with our future. Water supply and water is basically a necessity of life. The approval of 1,000 new housing units in the midst of a 1,200-year drought is neither reasonable nor moral decision to make. And it should be reversed. Even projects that have already have been approved, could have additional requirements attached for the developer. Sometimes it's decades between approval and actual building. Based on our current climate emergency, developers could be required to have permeable pavement, to use only native drought-tolerant plants in their landscaping, to include bioswales and recharge areas in their plans, to provide us for stormwater catchment, and be forbidden to pave over floodplains, for a few examples. There's money from Measure W to cover some of these sound regenerative investments. This is not a time for business as usual, ignoring our current climate reality, one we've never experienced as a civilization before, is completely irresponsible. I'm counting on you to be true public servants and make responsible decisions for the good of all residents. Cher Gilmore. All right, we do have two public comment cards that we've received. One is from Mr. Ed Dunn. Mr. Dunn, if you will.
Good evening. And I will let you know that your audio system is worse than last time. It's very difficult to know what you're saying. It's very muffled. I just thought And I hope they correct the clock because that's not part of my talk. I just thought I'd let you know. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Don. I asked you to let us know that, and I appreciate your comment. Yes.
Thank you. This is a letter to the directors, the board of directors, and I've presented a copy to the secretary so she can copy it and hand it out. And it says, dear directors, putting SCV Water on notice. We are constantly being reminded that we are in an uncontrollable drought. We are constantly pressured to reduce our potable water consumption. When will SCV Water start doing the walk? Where? Stop using drinking water to irrigate the Central Park, costing millions and using much water. Stop irrigating the medians and the other public parks with drinking water. Stop wasting recycled water, dumping it into the river, 30 million gallons per day for years, like 30 years. Stop dumping the output of the reverse osmosis drinking water into the river. Stop supplying drinking water to our fire hydrants. The construction people fill their trucks there. Now, I did a couple little ad libs in there, but the last sentence here was, you talk the talk. It is long past due for you to do the walk. And there are some other items that are not even in here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn. Ms. Noltmeyer, you submitted the comment card. Please, if you would come to the podium, make your comment.
Cam Noltmeyer, longtime resident here. We've lived here since the city was formed. And right now is probably the worst time we have ever seen the city and agencies like you in such distress. I think it's of your own creation. And I would like the new members to be made aware of what exactly your debt is. I think it's not brought up at all anymore, but it's huge. And I don't know how you are handling that. If I'm wrong, tell us. Tell us what your debt is right now, because right now, as far as ratepayers, we're completely ignored. And we're paying a lot more than we probably should be paying. And I'm concerned that some of our new members don't really realize how bad the situation is. I've watched it through the years, and you know, I constantly complained and will continue to do so. But I think right now you owe an obligation to the new members to tell them just how in debt you are as an agency. And I'm hoping to see you say I'm wrong. But not too long ago, I saw a cute little action. And that's another thing I've been running into. It's a problem with some of your employees where they just said, we're making this change of about 200 million or something. And I questioned it. And it was like, well, no, we just said it is. And another meeting, I called in because I prefer to call in. I prefer not to traipse down here and see you go through your tribulations. But I really think that you owe it to the new members on here and to the public for that matter to just show how much debt you have, because that time they were adding 2 million. And I thought, well, I know where that's going. It's going to be going on to the ratepayers of what they have to pay. And I object to that. I object to a lot of things that you do. And I just hope that you will explain your debt and how
you're
handling
it. Thank you, Ms. Noltmeyer, for your public comment.
Thank you, Ms. Noltmeyer. April, do we have any member of the public who would like to comment online?
We do not.
Very good. That concludes item 3, public comment. We can move on to item 4, approval of the agenda. Before we consider that item, there's no need for the closed session tonight, and items 12 and 13 have been removed from your agenda, so there'll be no closed session. I would ask the board, are there any additions, action items they would like, anything they'd like to add or change or modifications to the agenda at this time? Seeing none, the agenda is hereby approved. We can move on to, are there any public comment on the agenda tonight, April? Remote comment.
There is not.
Very good, thank you. Move on to approval of the consent calendar. You have 4 items on the consent calendar tonight. I would entertain a motion for approval of the consent calendar.
So move the consent calendar, Director Cooper.
Motion by Director Cooper.
Second, Atkins.
Second by Director Atkins. Is there any discussion? Is there any public comment on the consent calendar, April?
Just one moment. There is not.
Very good. We have a motion and a second. So now we are going to go into voting on our microphone. So
hold on just one moment while we get this set up. Okay.
First time is always a challenge.
Does your microphones have your, oh, it does. Has your votes. You can just vote mine yes, does, no, or abstain.
Mine does not.
Touch your screen.
Touch the screen. Oh, yes, it does. Now it does. All right. All right, so go ahead and indicate your vote. And then to close it, do you tap it again?
No, I'm going to stop the voting now. I'm just double checking all the votes. Okay. I'm going to stop the vote.
All right, so we have a 10 votes in favor and 0 votes opposed, but we have 11 directors.
I'm going to share the vote. We're missing Ms. Director Kelly is not in quite yet tonight. So this item does pass.
So the director colleague indicated his vote.
Director Kelly is not quite in tonight.
I'm sorry, Director Kelly is not. All right. So we are unanimously approved. Thank you very much. The consent calendar is hereby approved. We can move on to item 6, action items for approval. There are 4 action items on the agenda tonight. Unless Mr. Stone wants to make any opening remarks, we can move on to item 6. Are you good? All right, Mr. Stone is good. So we can move on to item 6.1. Presenter tonight is Shadi Bader. The item is to approve a resolution for construction contract with Pacific Hydrotech Corporation and a purchase order to Woodward and Curran Incorporated for construction management and inspection services, and a purchase order to Lee and Rowe Incorporated for engineering services during construction for the Earl Schmidt Filtration Plant Wash Water Return and Sludge Systems Project. Mr. Bader.
All right. Thank you so much, President Martin, and good evening, directors, fellow colleagues, and members of the public. This is Shadi Bader, senior engineer, and this evening I am pleased to present to you the bid opening results for the Earl Schmidt Filtration Plant Wash Water Return and Sludge Systems Project. This project will upgrade the plant's wash water and sludge collection processes at the Earl Schmidt. And once complete, this project will help us meet important operational goals and some operational flexibility as well. And will maximize and improve other processes throughout the plant. Before we start the presentation, I would like to As you know, Mr. Joe Burns is here with us today. He's from the agency's legal counsel, Best Best and Krieger. And Mr. Byrne will be available to answer any legal questions the committee members may have. So with that, let's get right into the presentation. Next slide, please. So here's a location map showing the Earl Schmidt Filtration Plant. The plant is located at 32700 Lake Hughes Road in Castaic, California. The plant can treat up to 56 million gallons per day of water stored in Castaic Lake. Next slide, please. Here's an overall site plan for the Earl Schmidt Filtration Plant. I highlighted some of the areas and components included in this project. Major additions include adding two new basins, wash water basins, to increase wash water storage from 800,000 gallons to a little bit over 2 million gallons. Also, we will add a new sludge thickener tank and a third sludge drying bed. We will also make changes and improvements throughout the plant to other components such as electrical and the lab area. Next slide, please. So this slide shows the basic components throughout the Earl Schmidt filtration plant. The main processes consist of an ozone injection system, contact clarifiers, filters, and storage reservoirs. The ozone injection system provides ozone to the blending of raw water and wash water. The flash mixing pumps mix water and chemicals, mainly coagulants and polymer, and lead to 10 contact clarifiers, followed by filtration throughout 10 filters. In the final stage, filtered water is disinfected with chlorine and passes through the newly built chlorine contact basin, monitored for chlorine residual and flows by gravity to two storage reservoirs reservoirs for distribution. The wash water generated by contact filters, clarifiers and filters, are stored in the wash water basins and pumped to the wash water treatment facilities. The treatment wash water is returned to the head of the plant where it will mix with new raw water from Castaic Lake. Next slide, please. So like we mentioned, the treated wash water is returned to the head of the plant where it mixes with the new raw water from Castaic Lake. Then all the collected solids will be treated in a gravity sludge thickener and finally will go to the drying beds. Next slide, please. So the project was advertised on Planet Bids beginning on November 10th, 2021. We also advertised the bid in the Signal newspaper on November 13th, November 20th, and November 27th of 2021. Bids were electronically received and opened on Planet Bids on February 23rd of 2022. We received 8 construction bids, with Pacific Hydrotech Corporation's bid being the lowest at $17,526,700. The overall top three bidders are within 5% of each other. The second bidder was 1.2% from the lowest bidder. And just to note that the engineer's estimate for this project is $18 million. Next slide, please. So project protest. On March 15th of 2022, staff received an official bid protest letter from Blois Construction. The letter is attached to your package this evening. Blois claims that the bids from both Pacific Hydrotech Corporation and GSC Construction have failed to comply with the bidding instructions and therefore should be declared non-responsive and that the contract should be awarded to Blois. After we received the bid protest, staff reviewed Blois's bid and have determined Blois's bid to be non-responsive, as Blois have used some wrong pages that were replaced in an addendum. Even though the agency did not have to investigate Blois's claims, since their bid is not responsive, staff and legal counsel have reviewed the bid protest, and staff and legal counsel still recommends that the board of directors award the construction contract to Pacific Hydrotech Corporation for the amount of $17,526,700, as we do not find Blois's claim to be valid. Next slide, please. So our consultant, Woodard and Kern, submitted the submitted a proposal to perform a construction management and inspection services for this project in the amount of $1,175,000. Next slide, please. Our other consultant, Leanne Rowe, who is the design engineer for this project, also submitted a proposal to perform engineering services during construction for the project in the amount of $660,000. Both Woodard and Kern and Leanne Rowe will be on a time and materials basis. Next slide, please. So here's the anticipated project schedule. This project was presented to the Engineering and Operations Committee on April 7th of 2022. And originally this item was planned to be presented at the May board meeting, but in an effort to help address material price volatility and fluctuation, this item is being presented to you this evening. And if the board chooses to proceed with this project, then we anticipate issuing a notice to proceed to Pacific Hydrotech Corporation around May of 2022. With 540 calendar days for construction, we anticipate completion of this of construction by November of 2023. Next slide, please, April. So with that, staff, the Engineering and Operations Committee recommends that the Board of Directors first adopt a resolution awarding a construction contract to the lowest bidder, Pacific Hydrotech Corporation, for the Earl Schmidt Filtration Plant Wash Water Return Sludge Systems Project for $17,526,700 and authorize the General Manager to issue a purchase order to Woodard and Kern Incorporated for an amount not to exceed $1,175,000 for construction management inspection services, and authorize the general manager to issue a purchase order to Leanne Rowe Incorporated for an amount not to exceed $660,000 for engineering services during construction. So with that, I have completed my presentation, and I'll hand it over back to you, President Martin. Thank you.
Thank you, Shadi. Excellent presentation. Before I ask for public comment, I want to acknowledge Chris and Jonathan. Whatever you did at the beginning of Shadi's presentation, the audio really improved quite a bit. And I'd like to, do we get a thumbs up from the Mr. and Mrs. Dunn in the back corner of the far reaches? Are we good on the sound? Excellent. Thank you. All right. With that, I don't have any comment cards on this item, but do we have any public comment by members attending virtually, April?
We do not.
All right. We have no public comment by members in attendance, and nobody wants to make public comment online. So with that, we can open up to board questions or discussion. Director Cooper.
Excuse me. I'll wait then if you were going to do discussion first. I was going to make a motion, but I'll hold off on that.
All right. Until discussion. Director Brownstein.
I'd like to hear from council if they could explain a little bit better about this whole.
Mr. Byrne.
Sure. Yeah. Happy to. With the bid protest. Yeah. So essentially, there was an addendum prepared by the low bidder. In the low bidder addendum, the claim from Blois was that two numbers were kind of switched. So amounts in which they had on one were far out of whack with what everybody else had for the other from the original proposal. And we looked at that and determined that because the overall bid price is the same, that it was immaterial and not something that was a problem for us, and we should proceed with a low bid. And I should say, staff spent quite a bit of time with Mike Maurer in our office, who was unable to be here tonight, but he's a construction contract attorney, and we wanted to make sure that we gave it a lot of diligence, which we did.
That's within our legal prerogative to do so.
Correct.
Thank you. That answer your question, Director Brownstein?
Yeah, I mean, there's a long letter with a lot of different issues, but I guess if you guys all reviewed it and it's satisfactory.
Yeah, I think we did. And again, as Shadi indicated, that Blois's bid was non-responsive as well. So we weren't obligated to respond to them in the way that we did, but we felt that that would be appropriate given that there was a formal bid protest.
Director Atkins.
Mr. Byrne, does Blois have any further recourse if we were to approve this tonight?
Our position is because they're non-responsive that they wouldn't have recourse, but doesn't mean that they couldn't bring an action to claim that they were inappropriately or that the award was inappropriately provided. We believe the risk to be very low.
Thank you.
And, yeah.
Well, welcome, Director Kelly. All right, Director Armitage.
Thank you. I want to say thank you for the board member, Mr. Mayle, and thank you to Mr. Bader for the presentation. I also want to say thank you to Mr. Mayle and Mr. Alvord for taking the time to answer my many, many questions that I had about this item ahead of time. They answered questions I had about how this would help with turbidity in wash water versus drinking water, because I was a little bit confused about that. So they cleared that up for me. And Mr. Mayle also addressed my questions that I had about how the agency ensures that inspection services that are contracted out separately, how that can be done properly and the related accountability process. So I appreciated that. I want to say I was glad to see 8 bids this time because I've been a little concerned with the decreasing number of bids that we've been receiving. So that was nice to see. I also want to say that I appreciate that it was noted in the memo that the selected bidder is registered with the Department of Industrial Relations and that they completed projects for the agency successfully before, because I found that helpful. Lastly, I appreciated the strategic plan objective that this project helps achieve and that it was stated in there, because that's very helpful to me too. So I'd like to continue seeing that information provided in future requests for board actions. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Armitage, and thank you for getting those questions answered ahead of the board meeting. That's going to save us some time tonight. I appreciate it, and I appreciate the staff's response to Director Armitage. With that, do we have any other questions? I think we're ready for a motion. Director Cooper?
This was reviewed in detail in the Engineering and Operations Committee, and I want to thank Shadi Bader and Courtney Mayle for the work that they put into this. It was very helpful. And with that, I would so move staff's recommendation.
We have a second.
Director Ozofsky seconds.
Director Ozofsky is second. Unless there's further discussion, we can go on to the vote phase. Excellent. We have 11 yes votes. And with that, this item is passed.
One moment, President Martin, to share the vote.
All right. Very good. Went flawlessly this time. All right. We are there. Pass this on. All right. With that, we can move to item 6.2. The presenter tonight is Maron Thirumaran. I think the Maron is a kind of a short name, but the first name is Yoganathan. I think it's the way it's pronounced. I apologize if I butchered the name, and we will try to learn from here forward. The item is to authorize the general manager to execute construction change orders up to $371,872 for the Valley Center Well PFAS Groundwater Treatment Improvements Project. And with that, Maron, please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, President Martin. Good evening, members of the board and members of the public. I'm Yoganathan Thirumaran, an engineer with the agency, and I'm also the project manager for the Valley Center Well PFAS Groundwater Treatment Improvements Project. We have a new change order item today due to unforeseen conditions on this project. I'll be providing you a construction update and recommend approval to increase the change order dollar amount for this project. Next slide, please. This slide shows the location map of the project. The image on the right shows the aerial image of the site. Next slide, please. These are a couple of pictures taken during construction. The picture on the left shows the ion exchange vessels mounted on the concrete pad and the plumbing manifold in between the vessels. The picture on the right shows the two pre-filters and some plumbing around it. The water gets treated through these pre-filters before it enters the ion exchange vessels. Next slide, please. These are some more pictures taken during construction. The first picture on the left shows an electrical cabinet being lifted off the delivery truck to its location. And the second picture shows the same cabinet being mounted on the concrete pad in the electrical room. And the third picture shows a gentleman applying the chemical resistant coating in the chemical room. Next slide, please. These are some pictures taken during the well rehab process, during the well redevelopment work. The first picture on the left shows a brush that was used to scrub and clean the well casing and the perforations. Second and third picture shows the plumbing assembly that was used to pump out the dirt and the debris and all the sediments from the bottom of the well. After the initial cleaning and using also some chemical treatment using hydrogen peroxide that was done initially, a video was taken, and watching the well video, it was noticed that there's a lot of bio growth and scaling still left in the well casing and in the perforations, and additional chemical treatment is required to clean those. So the contractor has provided a change order proposal, and that's why we are here today. And once the chemical treatment is completed, the next major step would be the startup process. We can go to next slide, please. This slide shows some of the cost related to the project. The first line shows the original contract amount, which is $2,996,800. Second line shows the general manager's change order authority. And the change order number one that we received, the proposal that we received is $252,000. I just want to mention that it's very critical that we don't stop the startup process or even delay by running into any issues. Without a contingency amount, even a small change order could cause a potential significant delay in the project. Therefore, besides requesting for the approval of the change order number one, we also would like to request to keep the general manager's original change order authority, approving change orders up to $119,872. It would basically increase the change order authority from $119,872, the ceiling would be raised to $371,872. I also want to mention that all the change orders will be carefully reviewed by the construction manager and the staff before approving, like it has always been. Keeping the general manager's original authority, change order authority, is only to prevent any further delays during startup. Typically, this item would have gone to the next month E&O committee. However, due to the time constraints and price volatility in today's market, we are here tonight with the committee chair's approval. Hence, we could avoid any potential delay claims. Next slide, please. Finally, staff recommends that the Board of Directors authorize the General Manager to execute construction change orders up to $371,872. This concludes my presentation, and thank you.
Thank you, Moran, for your presentation. Before we entertain board discussion questions, do we have any public comment? April, I have no cards on this item, but do we have any members of the public online who would like to comment?
No, we do not.
Thank you. But I do believe
Ms. Noltmeyer does have a public comment.
Very good. Come to the podium, Ms. Noltmeyer.
I've been following PFAS for a long time, and my question is, do you know the source of the PFAS that you were taking out? What is the actual and where is the source of the PFAS? Because we've been looking at a lot about PFAS, and it's costing a lot, as you can tell from here, to take it out of our water supply. It's a simple question. Do you know the source of the PFAS?
Is that the extent of your public comment, Ms. Noltmeyer?
Yes, it is.
Thank you very much. And this question has been raised by you a number of times. Mr. Stone, our general manager, has responded a number of times. I will leave it to Mr. Stone if he chooses to respond once again to the same question.
There are, as is known in the literature out there, there are a number of potential sources for what is a large family of perfluorinated substances, per and polyfluorinated substances, known as PFAS. The agency has initiated some litigation with manufacturers along one line of thinking. I think there's other work being done nationwide and in California to better assess potential sources and to help identify other potential areas to investigate. To say what the source is for this particular well at this time, I think would either be premature or potentially prejudicial to our legal action, which will be based on evidence developed in that case.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. I guess there are no further public comment, April. We can move on with the board discussion and questions on this item. Are there any?
There are no further public comments.
Very good. Any members of the board wish to question staff on the presentation or the change order? Director Plandek.
Yeah. I guess I don't understand why you're anticipating a certain amount for a change order. Maybe I didn't understand that properly in the presentation or something.
I see Courtney coming to the podium to respond.
Yeah, let me be clear. We have change order number one, which is for the $252,000. That's for the well cleaning. Do I have this on? Sorry. Okay. The anticipated amount or the additional amount is the change order authority that was already granted to General Manager Matt Stone. We just want to prevent any small items during the startup process that would increase that change order amount. And even if it were $1,000 without the additional authorization, we would have to come back to the board for that change order because we've exceeded the 4%. So we're trying to cover change order number one, which we've received in an exact amount, and then have the 4% contingency remaining. Ideally, we will not use any of that additional 4% contingency. And if we do have any additional items come up, they will go through our staff scrutiny, but we want to have that ability to keep the project moving.
That answer your question?
Yeah, Director? I think I understand it.
Very good. Are there any other questions from the board? Seeing none,
No, I'm sorry, I do have one more question. I think one of the reasons that we've, particularly myself, and I think some of the other members of the board have been concerned about change orders authority being raised, is that I think we would all like to make sure the change orders stay in the sunlight and are available for public scrutiny. So even though they wouldn't come to the board, I would expect that they would be presented to the board and disclosed to the board and available to the public and an explanation given of what they are. And I don't know if that's in this motion or not. I would like to add it if it's not.
So the motion would be to add a notification to the board on future change orders within
and,
this.
A memo or explanation of what happened.
Within this authorization.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think we can do that. Director Ozahusky.
I believe in the EO committee. Some feedback. I believe in the EO committee, all the change orders are listed. Is that right?
They are listed, and we will be able to present them at the ENO. That's typically where we would present our project change orders within general manager authority.
Director Planback, are you okay with
that? I think it's important that it comes to the whole board. People aren't necessarily watching committees. Oh, okay. Well, can it be all right? But it seems like it would be, thank you for reiterating that, but I think it would still be a good idea if it was a separate item, if it's a large change order.
Director Ozahusky, go ahead.
Sorry, one small question. On page 3 of the presentation, 47 of the packet, I don't see any spill trays. I imagine those are going to be installed afterwards. Is that right?
Maren, would you like to answer that?
Director Ozahusky, could you please repeat the question?
Sure. On your presentation, page 3 and page 47 of the board packet, we see pictures of a treatment plant. We see the PFAS treatment plant, and was wondering if the spill trays are not there because it's still in the construction phase, and those are going to be installed later down the line. Is that right?
Yes. You mentioned the trays?
So a collection site, in case there's a rupture, so it doesn't, it would capture some or most of it if it spills over.
The chemical room, there is where it will be mounted, there's room. Yes, inside the chemical building, there is room for to be collected, yes.
Okay, just want to confirm. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Mayo. Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Director Ozahusky. Are there any other questions from the board before we consider a motion on the item before us? I don't see any. Let me just make one comment. In my experience so far with the agency, is they've been excellent at controlling change orders, and they don't approve change orders that don't have adequate and complete justification. So I'm comfortable with moving forward with this. With that, I would like to have a motion on this item.
Director Ozahusky, a motion.
Motion by Director Ozahusky.
Second by Director Ford.
Second by Director Ford. Thank you. With that, unless there's further discussion, Madam Secretary, we don't have any more public comment. We've already had that. I guess we can go to the vote phase. We've got your vote right on the screen. Go ahead and vote.
Director Planbeck, thank you.
Very good. Vote appears to be complete and is unanimous in favor of adopting the motion.
Just a moment. Talking to Sheriff.
With that, the item is approved.
The votes are listed. And President Martin, to go back to item 6.1, that was resolution number SCV-272.
April, you didn't say 6.1, did you?
We're going back to item 6.1 just to put it for record that the resolution number for item 6.1 was SCV-272.
All right, very good. All right, we can move on to item 6.3, and this is a discussion and a possible amendment to the Board of Directors' policies and procedures related to director conduct. You have in your pocket, your packet, the full text of the board policies that are in your handbook. This came as a result of a request for an agenda item to discuss this. This didn't come with a recommendation to change the board policy. And my personal position on this is that the board policy is adequate to cover even the incident that we had with former Director Mortensen. We proved that by taking an action that wasn't specifically called out in the board policy. But with that as a little bit of background, I would entertain discussion, and if someone would like to make a motion one way or the other to change or not to change the board policy, we can do that. Director Armitage, go ahead.
Thank you. Well, I would respectfully disagree and say that the policy written as is actually did not give us any direction in the situation that we were faced. And it was only because the person chose to resign that we weren't kind of left in a pickle. So I think we've been presented with an opportunity to reevaluate the policy. And I'm thankful that that was brought to the attention of the board. I'll say that I did search online for a bit to see what other board codes of conduct say. And it didn't take me long to find a couple other boards include sections on specifically prohibitions against harassment. So others are clearly beginning to add this type of language into their codes of conduct. And I'd like to see us further explore similar language that also extends that to violence. So specifically, I'd like to see, in addition to the board policies and procedures that make it clear that one, SCV Water strives to make the workplace and the boardroom a place that is safe and free from harassment and violence. Two, that there's an expectation that board members not engage in harassment or carry out acts of violence in any setting. And three, if a board member is found guilty of harassment or violence, that the board may take action to remove that member. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Armitage. I do, in response to your respectful disagreement of me, I respectfully disagree with you that we were left in a pickle in the last incident. We brought an action to the board prior to Mr. Martinson's resignation in full consideration of the severity of the violation. So we were able to bring something to the board, even though it was not specifically covered in the policy. Do we have any other? Director Bronstein, go ahead.
I'm curious why any of us would object to adding this. It seems very simple, straightforward. I don't think any of us here think that any of us should harass or be violent. So I don't see why that would be an issue to add that, especially if somebody's convicted. I mean, it just reflects poorly on us if we condone that kind of behavior.
Okay. Director, Mr. Captain Colley.
Thank you. There's lots of things that we could list. I don't think anybody on the board should rob banks. And if you're convicted of robbing a bank, I think you probably ought to resign. I could think of more examples. I could probably go through the legal code of California and fill volumes of things that we should not do. As far as harassment, there are very specific laws that protect us from each other or protect our employees from violence and harassment. So I think trying to pick out just the most recent thing we had some experience with makes no sense to me, unless we're going to try to say, maybe you want to have just a general thing that directors should obey laws. And I think that it'd be kind of silly, but I don't see any reason to try to amend our policies to say that we will, in fact, obey the law.
Thank you, Director Conley. Director Atkins, did you want to add something?
Mr. Byrne, isn't it pretty clear that directors aren't to break the law? I mean, is that in this policy?
I'm not sure it's specifically stated in the policy, but clearly there are ramifications for that. And I would also note that to Director Armitage's third point, we don't have the ability to remove a director. Under certain circumstances, directors are required to, or a vacancy is created, and we talked about that the last time, a felony or even if it's a misdemeanor, if it involves your official duties, if you're convicted for something that involves your official duties, then that is essentially creates a vacancy and you're deemed to be no longer in office. But other than that, the board does not have the authority. And I think we mapped out in the last staff report what we felt the board options were, which are always available. And I think one of the reasons for not having it in the policy is kind of coming up, as there's a variety of different circumstances that might present themselves that are very different. But one of them is to censure, which is an expression of disapproval of the board for conduct. And the other is to the power that the board president has with relation to committees and whether they're sitting on committees and chairs of committees. There could be certain instances where the board would need to step in and enforce the law, but the board, independent of that, does not have the ability on its own to remove a director.
And this entire discussion is couched in terms of someone who had resigned. And I'm kind of at a loss as to why we have to change the policy if everyone is clear that we're not to break the law and the policy is designed to describe a course of action if a board member is found to be violating the policy. So if they're not a board member, what's the use in further discussion? I that's my point.
Director Ozoski.
I'd like to have you look on page 64 of your packet, page 4 of our board policy under section D, subsection 1. I quote, directors are obligated to uphold the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of California. Directors shall comply with applicable laws regulating their conduct. So I think it is in our board policy that we have to abide by the laws set forth by city, county, state, and our federal government. Back to you, President Martin.
Thank you, Director Ozoski. Director Plambeck.
I think perhaps where Director Armitage and Director Bronstein are raising concerns is that I don't recall in this policy any place where it's stated that we will we will not discriminate based on race, creed, color, gender, et cetera, which I think are like standard statements in contracts and federal contracts. And perhaps we could just add that. It's like a clear statement with the intention of the board to not discriminate in any way, not because harassment would be discrimination. Maybe that would be a good thing to add in.
You know, President Martin.
Director, I was a hospital. Oh, do you want to speak, Director Mr. Byrne?
Maybe it's go ahead.
Yeah, I apologize. If you look on page 65 of your board packet, page 5 of our board policy, leave it subsection 3, fair treatment and use of authority.
Yeah.
Quote, Directors in the performance of their official duties shall not discriminate against or harass any person on the basis of race, religious creed, color, age, marital status, national origin, ancestry, gender, sexual orientation, medical condition, mental disability, or physical disability. So
thank it, you, it is Peter. In there.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I apologize for missing that. I looked at that, and for some reason, it didn't register, so I apologize.
Director Bronstein, and I'll get to you, Director Armitage.
So I think part of my, I agree, we're not going to, we should all be law-abiding citizens. Yes, I agree with you right there. I think the problem, though, for me personally, is that we don't have a recourse on a violent misdemeanor. To me, that is something that I think is important, that we have, we can only, there's only action that we can do if it's a felony, right? But if it's a misdemeanor, and I understand that some of you are upset that the person is no longer here and all that, but also a lot of you kind of supported it. So to me, it's important that we make it clear that we're against violence, and even a misdemeanor would be a reason to ask somebody to leave the board.
Director Armitage.
Thank you. And I mean, along those lines, I feel like robbing, your example of robbing a bank or some type of financial crime is very, very different than a violent crime or sexual harassment or any type of criminal harassment, and should be treated as such. And again, it's one thing to state that directors should follow laws, and it's another to have a recourse for us to follow and a process that we can take should we find that someone has acted in a manner that is violent, and makes staff and other board members feel afraid or feel threatened. I think there's a big difference in that, and I hope that that is considered. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Armitage. Director Colley.
So I think I'm probably not the only one here that takes some offense to the accusation of supporting it. And I assume in the context of what you said that it is domestic violence and that we somehow or another supported it. I don't think anybody here supports domestic violence or has supported domestic violence in any way, shape or form. So I would hope that we not say publicly that there's anybody on this board that has supported domestic violence at all. Okay, that's, I think that, you know, I heard many people on this board say repeatedly that they do not believe domestic violence is a good thing or right, or, you know, they condemn it. I heard that many times. And I too would condemn domestic violence. So I'm not sure why. I mean, robbing a bank with a gun is considered by many to be a violent act. There are many, many, many violent acts. I'm not sure that anybody on staff here felt threatened by any director ever. I've not heard them say they were. And I'm not sure a policy that says that directors won't engage in violence would make staff feel any better. And I think the important point that was made by counsel is that we are not empowered by law to remove a director for conduct that we don't like necessarily. Okay, even if convicted of a misdemeanor violence, we have no authority. All we can do legally is, and I think the maximum we could do, is censure them and maybe encourage them to resign. There's other things that we could do, apply pressure perhaps, but I don't think it would be prudent to try to create a policy. I would recommend that if you feel strongly that folks that have been convicted of certain crimes should not be holding public office, then there's a legislature that makes those kinds of laws and could empower us to do that if they decided to do that. So that would be the place to start, is with a legislature, and try to get them to pass a law. And for this example, to say that somebody convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence should not be able to hold public office. I don't know. I think I might support that law. Okay. But it's not the law that exists today.
Thank you, Director Colley. Director Ozahosky.
Okay. I think language is very important here. And Director Armitage, you suggested that the policy states that we should comply with law. And that's not what it says here. We shall comply. You know, there's a difference between the two. And I would like Mr. Byrne to give an input on those two words here. It's not a request that we comply with law. It says we must comply with law. And it is stated in our policy. Am I correct on saying that, Mr. Byrne?
Yeah, I think you are stated in the strongest possible terms by the board.
Thank you, Mr. Byrne. Back to you, President Martin.
Thank you, Director Ozahosky. Do we have any other comments from the board? All right. We have some direct... Oh, Mr. Stone, go ahead.
Ill advice for the general manager to wade into this discussion, probably, but I think it is part of my job. I see the conundrum, and having gone through the process with legal counsel and the president to try to evaluate our options in the light of the recent case, and maybe removing that as there are, you know, we don't know what the future holds. Hopefully nothing that exciting or interesting, but a thought occurs to me that since we did identify censure is an option available to the board in a situation where something is concerning but falls short of the board's ability to, or the law's ability to, remove the person from office, would it be possible to consider language that would simply identify in the policies that censure is a process the board could avail itself to in circumstances? And I would leave that to the board to discuss if they're interested in that idea, language around that. I think you've got the expectations of conduct in the policy, and you've got access to censure based on advice of counsel, and we're prepared to do that in that last situation, but ultimately did not need to. But it may be just the missing piece is language in the policy that calls out that is a tool available to the board.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. Normally and generally, I always respect your opinion. I always value your guidance. In this case, I don't agree. I think the board came upon censure without having it written in the policy, and I'm confident that it would happen again the same kind of way. And so I think the slippery slope you defined just then with censure is one thing, but what do we apply censure to? That's where the difficulty comes. And so I'm not in favor of changing the policy, but those that would like to offer a motion to make an amendment to the policy, you're free to do so, and we'll consider it. Director Brunstein.
So I hear everybody here, and I have to say I'm a little disappointed. I really am. I don't know if anybody here really cares that I am, but I am, because domestic violence happens when people don't believe women, when they say that it's not the guy. I know him. He's a great person. No way. I go out. I play ball with him. I drink. He's a great guy. I see him every day. There's no way. And that's kind of what happened when this issue came up, if we're all honest. Because a lot of you have previous history, and that's the person that you know. And domestic violence happens behind closed doors in ways that none of us know. That's just how it is. And I think that some of us feel like it's important to make a stance about this, about violence in general, because I feel like we did fail in the last time that it came in front of us. And, you know, I feel silly making a motion that's not going to be accepted and that is not going to pass. I'm just really disappointed. That's all.
Vice President Gladbach.
I don't think it's anyone around this table that supports or even condones domestic violence. But that's just one issue. You know, there's a lot of other issues that we don't condone. But I don't want, as Director Colley pointed out, I don't want a whole 25 pages listing of actions whereby we would censor someone. I think it's Director Ochohowski has pointed out very clearly in here, you know, what our code of conduct is. And, you know, I want to emphasize, I don't think anyone condoned any action of domestic violence. I think that was misinterpreted. My comments were based upon the jury got it wrong when the jury, and I've been on juries where they don't listen to the instructions. And you end up, you know, with the wrong verdict. And that's what happened here. But I still condemn domestic violence or any other violence.
Thank you, Director, Vice President Gladbach. Director Cooper.
You know, I agree with you, Jerry, and none of us support domestic violence, but we also don't support drug abuse or child abuse or child endangerment, or there's a whole string of things that are bad that none of us support. So I think that our rules and regulations give us the ability now to whatever the issue may be, to take those into consideration. And if we decide to censure somebody, we can do that. Council has told us we can do that. So I think you need to take each one of those individually. We've had people on the board before that were drunks and were falling down drunk with their head on the table. But so if somebody goes out and gets a DUI, well, some people, that's going to really kick them off. Is that cause for censure? Well, it's up to the board. So I think we have the rules and regulations. It says everybody must follow the laws as they're written. If somebody steps out of line and does something bad where the board feels that it's an effect to the agency, then we can censure them. So I'm okay with what we have now. I don't see a need to add anything on. I certainly don't want to add just domestic violence on. And I'm on the Child and Family Center Domestic Violence Board. And it's, you know, I've seen the kinds of things that this happens. But I don't think that we need to add that specifically into our rules and regulations, because there's a lot of things that people do that need to be added into those kinds of things. So, you know, I think some of us have been on the board a long time. And this is the first case of anything like this that we've ever seen. And if the person had stayed on, we had the ability to censure and handle that. So I think we're okay where we're at. I would not support making any changes at this point.
Director Kelly.
I think there are many directors on here who have a great passion in this subject, believe in it very much as they should be. But I just seem to see the conversation going directly to domestic violence of women and domestic violence of men and other subjects is just as pronounced as anything here. And so I think when we're condoning domestic violence, we're condoning it in all subjects, all human beings. And I just want to make sure that I don't detract from the fact that definitely support those here that are talking about women, but also want to make sure that we reach out and make sure that domestic violence doesn't happen, period. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Kelly. All right, Director Armitage, go ahead.
Thank you. One more question for council. So I know you've spoken to this a bit, but so in your opinion, there's no other language or no other examples that you've seen in other organizations or bodies or boards that would give more options to a board in these types of circumstances?
Not that I'm aware of. I do think we're talking about, there's two kind of things here. One is a statement. We can certainly make a statement in the policy. And then the other issue is, I think what you're driving at more is, what is the ability of the board to do something? And I, again, I think the law is pretty clear on what we can do. And again, you know, we don't elect people, obviously, to be on the board. And so that's the reason why the board can't get rid of people. But again, if there's a statement that I want to be made, that is different. We can certainly put whatever statements we wanted to into the policies. And I'm not saying there may be other policies out there that have looked at certain statutes and certain, there's like, you know, incompatible offices. If you held two offices, at some point an agency could actually, you know, go to the AG and bring some kind of a lawsuit. But it's in this type of situation, I'm not aware of any other options.
Thank you, Mr. Byrne. I just like to remind the board, they don't necessarily need a reminder, but I would like to point out, since there's been characterizations made about the support for the offending board member, and that certainly was not uniform across the board. Director Gladbach, Vice President Gladbach, Director Cooper have already said that we don't condone any kind of violence, domestic violence or otherwise. And I would like to point out for the record that as soon as the conviction came down, Mr. Mortensen was removed from the Finance Committee and certainly his position as chair of the Finance Committee. And we moved forward with an action for that we put on the board for consideration. I was fully prepared to vote in favor of that action. And that was in the absence of anything specific in our policy that would direct us in that regard. And so I think if a similar situation came up, we would follow the same course likely. And one more point I'd like to make is that every year the full board is trained by lawyers from BBK on harassment, sexual harassment, other kinds of harassment, gender harassment. I couldn't probably recite all the different kinds of harassment that we're trained on. And in that training, we are educated on the consequences of that. And so I still don't see a need to put in our board policy things that are commonly understood in our culture that are not to be done, and there are consequences for it. And so with that, I will ask again, members who would like to see an action, if you want to propose a change to the board policy, feel free to do so. Director Armitage.
Well, I mean, I would like to see some language added. I just don't know what I'm asking for at this point. I feel like I need some more conversation and thought around this. So is there a way that we can take a little bit more time with this?
Well, I would ask for guidance from legal counsel. If we entertain a motion for legal counsel to propose changes to the board policy along the lines of what you've heard tonight. Is that taken action by the board to do that?
You could just give direction. I don't think we need to vote. It would ultimately come back as another agenda item with any proposed language.
I would point out that we're spending agency money having legal counsel come up with a proposal that I think you've heard a number of directors say we don't need. So I would be opposed to that. We've already gone on record as saying it's not necessary, and I would be opposed to spending legal counsel agency money having to do that. So, Mr. Byrne, is there a motion we can take to record this?
Yeah, certainly. Yes. Yeah, it's agendized very broadly. We can take whatever action we like related to the subject matter here.
All right. So if the Director Colley.
I guess I'll take the unusual step of making a motion to take no action so that we can.
Very good. Motion this. On the table for take no action. Do we have a second?
Second, Atkins.
Second by Director Atkins. Is there any further discussion? All right, let's call for the vote. April. We have a public comment, you say? April, do we have a public comment? Ms. Noltemeyer is waving her hand. Oh. I don't know what that means. You have a public comment. Ms.
Noltemeyer, do you have a public comment? Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we've.
Do you want to allow her to make public comment?
Go ahead and make the public comment, Ms. Noltemeyer.
Ms. Noltemeyer, hold on just one moment. Just have to get my timer back up, just one second. Ms. Noltemeyer, please begin.
I know you're making a hard decision. I just wanted to put in my complaint about a change that was being made in the policy. And that has to do with the ratepayer's advocate. And you're removing it. It says here, after such date, the board may eliminate the position of the ratepayer's advocate. And I strongly think we need a ratepayer's advocate because I don't know. I know you have hard problems, other more serious to discuss, but I just wanted to bring that up, that I object strongly to that being eliminated. As a ratepayer, that's the only thing we have going for us, because I know that without that, and I have seen them struggle. I have been at every meeting.
Director Cooper, go ahead. I think this does not relate at all to the agenda item that we're considering, Ms. Noltemeyer.
I think it does, but anyway.
Mr. Byrne, can you?
Yeah, I think that the agenda item, Ms. Noltemeyer, was related to director conduct. So it was on the board policies and procedures, but specifically related to proposed amendments having to do with conduct. Yeah.
Well,
I can speak to you afterwards if you like, because it actually is handled in our act.
I'm looking at our policies, procedures for the board of directors for the Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency. That's what I'm looking at.
This is a consideration of a change to the policy as it relates to director conduct.
I'll talk with you afterwards if you like about that. I've got the answer.
Thank you. All right, we can continue the vote. Those who haven't voted, please weigh in.
Just give me one moment, President Martin, just to calculate the vote. Just one moment. President Martin, this item does, as per the motion, the policies of the board will stay the same. No changes.
Thank you very much. Thank you, board, for the discussion. We can move on to Director Plamba.
We're having an upcoming workshop to discuss various board issues, which I didn't quite understand what sort of like. Are we going to all get along or something? Maybe this could be an agenda item.
That's a good point.
Director Armitage and Bronstein could put a little more thought into it and do another presentation, or maybe we could just have a discussion about it.
Okay, very good. Good suggestion. All right, we'll move on to item 6.4. This is discuss and consider electing a second vice president for the remaining 2022 calendar year. This is another item that was, we were asked for an agenda item to consider this. With that, anyone who would like to express an opinion or desire one way or the other?
President Martin, should we open up for public?
We have any public comment? We've not made a presentation necessarily, so just the subject matter. Do we have a member of the public who would like to comment?
No, we do not.
Very good. All right, we'll continue with the board discussion. Is there someone who would like to express an opinion or a position one way or the other? And by the way, we will not be appointing a second vice president if, in fact, it is the board's pleasure to move forward with an appointment of a second vice president. That will occur at a future board meeting. So tonight we're just deciding whether we're going to have a second vice president, and that's the extent of it. Director Kelly.
I feel there's strong value in having two people at the leadership role. If something happens to the president, we have somebody that can step up. I think we've shown with COVID that there was a possibility of having one, two, or even all three, having some complications with health issues. It doesn't cost us anything. It doesn't cost us any money. It doesn't cost us any votes. And I think it just gives us more of a stability up there in the, on the podium or on the decision-making table there. And I'm all in favor of keeping it with the president and two vice presidents.
Okay. Is that a motion?
I'd be glad to make that as a motion.
It's up to you.
So be it.
Okay. Director Armitage?
Thank you. I also support the idea of having a second vice president. I think it helps foster and build leadership skill building. And I think that's always a good thing on anybody for any organization. Thank you.
Thank you. Vice President Gladbeck.
This organization and the previous organizations have been here for 50, 60 years. And it wasn't only until the last few years where there was a second vice president. And I think that was recommended because they felt that the subject of public outreach and legislation wasn't getting a fair shake. So I want to amend the motion by saying it will be reconsidered January of next year when officers are reelected.
Well, Mr. Byrne, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, we're kind of procedurally getting a little, we don't have a second yet. And I'm thinking someone may want to second it. But maybe we could have discussion first and then a second, and then we can go into it.
All right. Director Armitage?
Was there a second?
I will second if it's appropriate at this time.
So now we have a second. Now we can consider Vice President Gladbeck's.
I move that we like to amend the motion by saying it will be reconsidered at January 23 at our first meeting when we elect officers.
Okay, so this is a motion to amend. Is that correct?
Yeah. That's correct. So let me just make sure I understand. So that means that we would remain at the existing, there would not be any action to have a second vice president until that time.
Stay status quo.
Correct.
We'll take two vice presidents from now until the end of December.
Okay, I'm sorry. I wasn't understanding.
Then we'll reconsider what we're going to do. Can you
speak that? We don't understand.
Yeah.
Sure, no problem. That, let me try to think. Okay, I support the idea of if we're going to have two vice presidents, it's only going to be for the remainder of this year, basically. So.
Okay, well, that's the normal term of the board officers anyway.
I think that is, yeah. If it's okay with Director Gladbeck, then I think the existing motion would maybe still be on the table because we would reconsider it at that time anyway.
Right.
President Martin, just to be clear, the board did vote to have two VPs till the end of this term. So in 2023, they voted to go back to one president and one vice president, one vice president, just due to the fact that we went down to nine. So the item on for tonight was just to have two VPs to complete the term. And then we'd go back to one VP come January of 2023.
Of course, the board can reconsider that motion in January as well.
That's right.
So I think the motion remains. Director Cooper, would you like to add something?
So the board secretary is telling us we really don't need a motion for anything tonight because the board has voted to have two vice presidents until the end of this year. And then it's reconsidered by the board next year. So there's no reason to even have a vote tonight, is there?
Only if the board decided tonight to stick with just one VP for the remaining of the calendar year. That was the point of the item, was to see if they wanted to replace the previous vice president, or if they wanted to just have one VP for the rest of the remaining year of this year.
Director Kelly.
In understanding the facts that everything will stay status quo, I'd like to remove my motion to make any changes. I made a motion, but we don't need the motion, so I'd like to cancel my motion. All right. And of course, you have a second that has to make a decision.
Yeah. Well, I withdraw as well then.
The board's decision tonight is to decide if you do want a second VP to complete the term of to complete this calendar year.
Okay.
That's what the board needs to vote on tonight.
Okay, so it's basically a endorsement of the previous vote the board made to have two vice presidents until the end of the term. Is that necessary, Mr. Byrne?
Yeah, I mean, and I'm learning a little bit of this as I'm listening. I think if the vote was to until the end of the year, then I agree that there's no action that's necessary tonight unless somebody wants to make a motion to only have one vice president.
Okay. That's
simple. The status quo would be two. If you'd like to have one, then there'd be a motion, yeah.
Well, we're very sorry to confuse everyone on this, but thank you for straightening this out. We have a couple of hands. Director Collins.
So I will make that specific motion to conclude this year with a single vice president and not appoint a replacement vice president.
All right. That motion is now on the table. Do we have a second?
I believe you have a motion from Director Gladbach that does not have a second. Does that not have to be addressed first?
Yeah, I think Director Gladbach's motion was deemed moot by the clarification that April had made, that what he was asking for was already an action of the board.
All right, so before we ask for a second for Director Colley's motion, Director Bernstein, would you like to say something?
Yeah, I'm curious why we're not just electing a vice president now if we decided that that's something that we wanted to do, because we're talking about wasting time.
Well, I think the board secretary at least let me know that she wasn't prepared tonight to facilitate an election of a board officer.
Oh, okay, because it just says discuss and consider electing a second vice president. And I just figured I don't think any of the players are going to change in the next.
Okay. Tonight is the action tonight to decide yes or no, are we going to have a second vice president?
Okay.
We will do the selection at a future board meeting. So we do have a motion on the table to not have a second vice president. So I would like to know, is there going to be a second on Director Ozahowski? You have your hand up.
Just a question to you, President Martin, and a follow-up question to Vice President Gladbach.
Director Ozahowski, can you speak into the microphone? Sure. I know Ms. Dunn is having trouble hearing.
How about now? Is that good now?
That's better.
Okay. So the workload when planning items on the agenda, working on the schedule with the board secretary, is it helpful for you to have a second vice president, or can you do that work just the two of you right now?
Well, it's actually three of us because it's the past president plus the current slate of board officers. So we do still have three.
Okay, so it'll be four total if you have a second vice president.
Four total, that's correct. And then to remind everyone, and of course, Mr. Stone knows that better than anybody, most of the work done for agenda planning comes from staff. Yes, we are in the room and comment on agenda items coming up, but the purpose of an agenda is to consider items of business that the board needs to move forward with to conduct the business of the agency. And therefore, most of the work comes from Mr. Stone and his staff.
Same question to Vice President Gladbach.
As I understand what you're saying, do we really need a second vice president?
Correct.
Right. No, we do not need. I second Director Colley's motion. All right.
Director Armitage.
Thank you. I would just like to point out that the people currently serving in leadership positions have been on this board or with the agency for a period of time. And I appreciate the experience you bring to that, but I would hope that you are looking to mentor and bring up people who haven't had that experience to learn some of what you're doing at the leadership level. And with that, I again would like to see that a second vice president be given that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we have a motion and a second. Unless there's further discussion, the motion is to not have a second vice president. And it's been seconded by Vice President Gladbach. So that is what we're voting on at the moment.
President Martin, just give me one moment to calculate the votes. Sorry, I just want to make sure I get this right. So give me just one moment. This item does pass as only one single VP, but I'm going to share the votes. Just give me one moment.
I'd like to raise a point of order if I could.
Go ahead, Director Colley.
I think it does not pass because even though we have a majority, this board has decided to interpret our act to require a majority to pass any motion requires a majority of the seats available on the board.
That's correct.
And so I believe
this is a tie. This item does not pass.
It creates a very interesting dynamic now, because I don't see how we could elect a vice president, given that we, assuming that six of us believe that we should have none, then six of us would never vote for anyone, I guess. I don't know. But it's an interesting problem.
All right. Nonetheless, that's the rule we're following. And this measure does not pass. Therefore, we will take up an action at the next board meeting to elect the second vice president. Director Kelly, did you want to have something to say?
I'd like to say that one thing that we've been proud of as a board and as an agency is to continue to reach out to new directors, continue to give them the opportunity for education, sending them to conventions, sending them to training classes. And I just hope that the set of officers here and the set of officers in the future continue that trend so that they can eventually learn more about the agency, learn more about water, and step into those shoes. And I'm all in favor of, new voices, new faces, as long as they're educated voices and faces. So just a comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Kelly. I believe that completes the item. The motion was to not have a second vice president, which failed. So therefore, we are going to have a second vice president, which will be taken up at a future board meeting. I'm not sure it'll be the next one, but at a future board meeting in the near future.
The first board meeting in May.
First board meeting in May, which will be May 17th, I believe.
That is correct.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, board, for the discussion and thoughtful consideration. With that, we can move to item 7, which is a CEQA presentation presented by Best Best and Krieger, Sarah Osowitz. And it is entitled, I think it's Everything You Want to Know About CEQA. Is that correct, Joe? So go ahead. If we have our presenter ready to proceed, please proceed.
Yes. I could just say that Sarah is the primary point person on CEQA issues for the agency, and it's been helping us out quite a bit. And I'll turn it over to you, sir.
Yes. Good evening, board members. Maybe I should check first to make sure everyone can hear me.
We can.
Fantastic. And April and I emailed back and forth earlier today, and she has very kindly agreed that when I say next slide, she'll change slides. So next slide. So good evening. So our topic today is just to discuss the California Environmental Quality Act and really not take too much time doing that, but to try to address topics that we think may be of interest to you and to facilitate implementation of the California Environmental Quality Act or CEQA in your work in the future. I do this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I have been for 22 years. So this is really going to be a very broad overview. We could talk about CEQA till the cows come home, and I have done so in the past. So we're going to do an overview of when CEQA applies, what kinds of environmental review can be conducted from CEQA exemptions to negative declarations to environmental impact reports. Next slide. And in doing so, we will be talking about that which makes up CEQA. And CEQA is somewhat uniquely in California, is made up of the statute, otherwise known as CEQA, Public Resources Code Section 2100 et sec, but it's also made up of a section of the California Code of Regulations. It is Title 14, Section 1500 at SEC, but you will rarely, rarely ever hear it called that. You will hear it called the CEQA guidelines. And while they do not have the force of law, they are in fact regulations. They are implemented by OPR, the Office of Planning and Research. But absent some directly contradicting statute or case law, courts will apply the CEQA guidelines. And the third and perhaps most flexible part of CEQA is case law. And by case law, I don't mean anything that a trial court says, a LA County Superior Court, Riverside County Superior Court. I mean any published case coming from any one of the six California Courts of Appeal or from the California Supreme Court. And they apply and interpret CEQA and the guidelines almost on a daily basis. And I think due to the controversial nature of CEQA, most, not all, but most changes and new law, if you will, in CEQA comes by a judge-made law, not by the statute or the guidelines. Next slide. So today we're going to be talking about the big picture, which is really five elements: trigger, project, exemption, next slide, preliminary review, and level of review. There might be one more slide. Next slide. Ah, not more points. Preparing an ENIA. We're going to get to these in more detail. So this is just the big overview. Preparing an environmental document, releasing that document for public review and comment, and then considering everything in that process to decide whether or not to approve or disapprove a project. This is, to me, one of the most often misunderstood components of CEQA. CEQA documents are not approval documents. Adopting or certifying or determining a project's level of environmental review is not the same as approving the project. It's merely the same as saying we have presented all the necessary information to ourselves to help us make a decision to approve or disapprove an action. Next slide. Now, after you have approved or disapproved an action, as I think many of you in this room know, there is the possibility of being sued. And that possibility is typically based on statute of limitations from 30 to 35 days. However, if the agency takes an action that someone claims is subject to CEQA, but they did not issue a notice about their CEQA determination, if you can believe it, the statute of limitations is 180 days. It's 6 months. So that can be a very significant thing. And so, yes, an agency like your own can be sued for violating CEQA, either by not supporting its decisions with substantial evidence or by violating any of the procedural requirements of CEQA, by which I mean the Public Resources Code, the CEQA guidelines, and to the extent courts interpret those, violating a court-based interpretation of CEQA or the CEQA guidelines. Okay, next slide. So now digging a little bit in, Board Member Ford asked me to make a special point of distinguishing between these two elements, which I think is so important for the agency. And that is because you are often the lead agency under CEQA, but you are often something else. So we'll start with lead agency. And it's lead agency is pretty much what it sounds like, the public agency with the principal responsibility for carrying out or approving a project. It is the lead agency that decides what kind of CEQA document will be required for the project. And in fact, in addition, it's the lead agency that would decide whether no CEQA document is required for a project because the project is in some way exempt from CEQA. And when a lead agency has the principal responsibility for carrying out or approving a project, they can have that responsibility because they will actually build it, they'll actually do it, or because they have the lead permitting responsibility. Somebody else will build it, but without their main permit, it won't go forward. Next slide. But the agency often also sits as a responsible agency. And that, again, sort of sounds like what it means, but it's a little bit more term of arty. So if there's a lead agency, then there may also be a responsible agency. And the you guys often sit, guys and gals, often sit as a responsible agency because someone, say the County of Los Angeles, has approved a project. And now a subsequent approval is needed. Something less than the large approval, say less than the approval of a specific plan or a tentative map. Or maybe it's the approval of a giant new roadway that is going to require you all to build a new alignment for some pipe. And so you're not approving the new roadway. That's the major project that the lead agency did seek before, but you are acting as a responsible agency, relying on that roadway CEQA document to evaluate the environmental impact of maybe a small pipeline reconfiguration that you will approve, but that was already looked at in the CEQA document prepared by the lead agency. Okay, next slide. So what does the lead agency do? Interestingly, there isn't a lot of guidance for responsible agencies. It's mostly in the CEQA guidelines in section 15096. And so going to use my example of a lead agency conducting CEQA for the construction of a major roadway, just using that as an example, it is appropriate for you as a responsible agency to consult with that agency, maybe they're Caltrans, prior to their preparation of an EIR or a neg deck to review the EIR or negative declaration that's prepared, and to consider whether you think that EIR or neg deck is inadequate for your purposes. Actually, if you think it is inadequate, you, like any other member of the public, as a responsible agency, actually have the right to sue the lead agency. That is very rare. But assuming that you don't sue the lead agency to challenge the adequacy of their CEQA document, then when you approve the subsequent discretionary approval, you adopt mitigation measures and findings consistent with the CEQA work that was done by the lead agency. So you're going to approve, let's say, this pipeline reconfiguration, this small movement of a pipeline to get out of the way of a road or new construction of a road, and you're going to do it based on the information you have obtained from the lead agency's CEQA document. Next slide. So next slide. So we talked about the steps, and I'm going to go through these as quickly as I can. When does CEQA apply? Well, it applies to public activities, and that's what we're, as an agency, dealing with, issuing a permit, building a structure or infrastructure, and significantly for your purposes, acquisition of a water source, participation in a groundwater banking program, adoption of a planning document like a recycled water master plan, which you all have absolutely done CEQA for in the past. So these are agency actions trigger. Next slide. But then you ask yourself, is that trigger a trigger for a project? Next slide. So if it's a project, it has to be a discretionary act. And the best example, not perfect one for your purposes, but it's usually the easiest for folks to track, is when you build a new building, you're supposed to use, let's say, under the building code, 2x4s on a certain wall. And you will not get sign off on your building permit unless you have used 2x4s. That is not a discretionary decision. You've either used a 2x4 to build this wall or you haven't. It's binary. But a discretionary act by a public agency is what will trigger CEQA if, and again, we have a third point, discretionary act by a public agency with the potential to result directly or indirectly in a physical change to the environment. I have certainly seen people say things like, well, how could a recycled water master plan do anything? It doesn't authorize anything. It just says what we're looking for in the future. And then that's where the concept of the indirect, reasonably foreseeable physical change comes up. Next slide. So this has also come up, I think, a number of times
for the agency. And so we thought we would talk about this very particular case out of the County of Orange in the city of Irvine from 2013. And in that case, something you all do a lot, the county took a vote to approve the submittal of an application for a grant. You all do that a lot. In this case, the County of Orange decision to submit an application for funding for an expansion of a jail was found by the court not to be a CEQA project, even if it gave some impetus to the expansion and even if it included information about that expansion. And the reason was, the court said, because simply by applying for a grant, it did not preclude the County of Orange from considering alternatives or mitigation measures, or really from conducting full CEQA analysis of a future jail expansion. And also because simply because they applied for the grant did not guarantee that they would be applying money to a jail expansion. So we think about this case a lot when the agency approves and submits applications for various grants. It's not always a strong fit, but many times it is. Many of your actions to submit applications for grants are not themselves CEQA projects. Next slide. So let's say we have a project. Is it exempt from further CEQA review? Next slide. So there are three types, and I know it gets a little bit hard to say overall. There are statutory exemptions, categorical exemptions, and then another exemption, which isn't actually even a numbered exemption, but it has come to be known as the common sense exemption. Statutory exemptions are kind of what they sound like. They're absolute. They're in the statute. CEQA just says, boom, this is not a project. The 1984 Los Angeles Olympic buildings were not subject to CEQA. The Napa Valley wine train, not subject to CEQA. But then we have categorical exemptions. Again, in the CEQA guidelines, classes of projects, which though they are subject to some exceptions, are generally exempt from CEQA review. And then we have the common sense exemption. Next slide. So in order to determine, aside from statutory, if a project is exempt, that determination needs to be supported by the magic words in CEQA, pretty much always substantial evidence. Facts, reasonable assumptions predicated upon facts and expert opinion, not argument, not speculation, nothing clearly erroneous. So deciding that a project is exempt from CEQA because it meets all of the parameters of an exempt project, or because it meets all the parameters of a common sense exemption, has to be supported by substantial evidence. Next slide. Statutory exemptions. Some of these, again, pretty common sense, and some of them very much apply to this agency. Emergency repairs to public services. Projects of less than 1 mile within a right-of-way for installation and repair of pipeline. Inspection, maintenance, restoration of existing pipeline. And significantly, urban water management plans are statutorily exempt from CEQA review. Next slide. Another common exemption employed by the agency is what we call the Class 1 exemption, CEQA Guideline 15301, where there's negligible expansion of existing use. You're just repairing something that already exists. It's a public feature. It could be a roadway. It could be a pipe, actually. You're repairing it. It's a categorical exemption exempt from CEQA. Next slide. And then, though it sounds like it's the easiest exemption, I would argue it's the hardest, the common sense exemption, where it can be seen with the certainty there is no possibility ever, not substantial evidence, not anything, no possibility at all in the world that a activity would have a no impact on the environment. It's actually all somewhat rare to see. Next slide. So, and we always advise, document your substantial evidence in every step
the city takes, the agency takes. That's why we put information in the staff report about the CEQA review and findings in the resolutions. Next slide. So if the project does not qualify for any of those exemptions, statutory, categorical, or common sense, then the impacts need to be analyzed. Next slide. And usually that's done via what's called an initial study. There's a checklist published by the Office of Planning and Research at the back of the state CEQA guidelines called Appendix G. And it sets forth the resource areas that you're probably familiar with for categories under CEQA: aesthetics, air quality, noise, hazards. And it leads you through a series of threshold questions. Next slide. The thresholds of significance, again, are what they sound like. Something is either significant or it's less than significant. But if you're going to adopt a threshold, which you can just take from the Appendix G guidelines, or you can adopt yourself based on your own scientific and factual data that you choose to rely on, you can determine the threshold of significance you would like to apply to analyzing, say, a project's aesthetic impacts, its noise impacts, etc. Next slide. So using the initial study, you may determine that all of the impacts applying thresholds are less than significant. Then you can proceed with a negative declaration. Or you could decide that all the impacts can be mitigated to a less than significant level through the implementation of mitigation measures, like perhaps watering down dust from construction. That would be a mitigated negative declaration. But an EIR, an environmental impact report, is prepared when there is a fair argument, which is not substantial evidence, just a fair argument, that the project might result in a significant impact that you wouldn't be able to mitigate fully to less than significant. Next slide. So negdecs, again, that's only where there's no substantial evidence that the project may have any effect on the environment. Next slide. And when we say no fair argument of a potentially significant impact, I always say in negdecs and mitigated negdecs, tie goes to the challenger. So if a challenger, a member of the public, disagrees with the environmental analysis in a negdec or a mitigated negdec, and they present substantial evidence of a fair argument of a potentially significant impact, the tie goes to them. The agency can't rely on its own experts when faced by substantial evidence of a fair argument challenging a negdec. Next slide. And it's for this reason that both in negdecs, mitigated negdecs, and EIRs, mitigation is often adopted, very detailed mitigation that needs to be both feasible, meaning it can be done technologically, legally, scientifically, and enforceable, meaning you don't need some third party, a private property owner, to cooperate with you, that you as an agency can enforce it yourself. Next slide. So we've gone through this test. Next slide. So an EIR is when you have any substantial evidence that there might be a fair argument of the project having a significant effect on the environment. And I'll be honest with everyone, typically, though CEQA affirmatively says you're not supposed to prepare an EIR just because a project is controversial, typically that is what triggers the preparation of an EIR. Next slide. Now, when a draft EIR is issued, there'll be a public comment period. And I should say there's generally a public comment period after a negdec. But that will be between 20 and 30 days. For an EIR, it will be 45 days. And by law, a lead agency must respond to each comment in writing submitted on the EIR. Lead agencies don't have to respond in writing to each comment on a negdec or mitigated negdec, though they typically do. Next slide. If significant new information comes up after the draft EIR is out on the street, it has to be recertified. Now, it might just be recertified recirculated, excuse me, only one chapter, maybe the aesthetic section, the utility section, but possibly the whole document might be recirculated, which would be revision and a whole new 45-day public comment period. Next slide. Next slide. So again, if a project is exempt, as we discussed at the beginning, you all can approve the project by resolution, including a finding as to why the project is exempt. You can file a notice of exemption after approval, though it's not required, and that will set out a 35-day statute of limitations. Next slide. The same is true of the neg deck, only in this case you would adopt the mitigation monitoring and reporting program. So you'd be approving adopting the neg deck and then approving and adopting the mitigation measures. And then you would file a notice of determination as opposed to a notice of exemption. After that, you would have a 30-day statute of limitations. Next slide. An environmental impact report has one piece that neg decks do not have, and that is if the EIR finds that there is an impact that cannot be mitigated to a level of less than significance, agency or the lead agency, or you as a responsible agency or as lead agency, can still approve the project if you make what's known as a statement of overriding consideration that accompanies the adoption of the project approval and accompanies the certification of the EIR. And that's not an environmental statement. That's a statement of, we think for the following policy and frankly, environmental reasons, that even though, let's say, this project may have significant and unavoidable air quality impact, we still think overall this is good for our agency, this is good for our water agency, this is good for our state. We want this roadway no matter what. So that would happen only in the instance of the certification of an EIR. Could not do that with a neg deck or mitigated neg deck. Again, you would file a notice of determination after project approval, and there would be, in this case, a 30-day statute of limitations. Next slide. So that was a lot of information very, very quickly for that. I apologize, but as Joe will tell you, Mr. Byrne, I am always around. I am happy to answer any questions the day of the hearing, the day after the hearing, 2 weeks before, 2 weeks after. We are always around and happy to talk tonight as well.
Thank you very much, Sarah, for the presentation. Very interesting, very informative. Madam Secretary, do we have any public comment on this item?
We do not.
Very good. So then we're open to board questions. Anybody have a question for Sarah or comment? Director Planbeck, go ahead.
So I've always been confused about responsible agencies. And one thing that's confused me is when a CEQA document is really old and some of the information is obviously incorrect based on what's going on currently, but we have to accept it anyway unless we've commented on it like 15 years ago or something. It looked like you said you could add more mitigation to it or something.
What I would say is that, well, what I mean about adding mitigation, I mean, you can adopt mitigation, but when you're approving as a responsible agency, you're only adopting the mitigation relevant to your area of jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, if there's aesthetic mitigation, it's unlikely you would be adopting that. But to your first question, there is no magic number of years after which an environmental or CEQA document becomes stale. So I very much acknowledge what you're saying. The possibility exists if it is many years down the line, many years. And I'll just be a little vague about that because there is no bright line, that you might find that the approval before you requires the preparation of a supplemental or subsequent negative declaration or EIR because there have been a change in circumstance, or that the project approval actually before you
if implemented, will result in new or more severe environmental impacts than were disclosed in the original CEQA document. That is relatively unusual. Usually responsible agency actions occur within a year to a few years after the lead agency action, and then it's rarely appropriate. But yeah,
I saw one just recently that was based on a 1994 EIR that the county couldn't even find. It was pretty discouraging. Uh-oh, did we lose her?
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I appreciate knowing that we could even add additional information to it because I didn't know that.
Well, and I'm happy to provide a guideline section that discusses it, but it is not in the, I would not say it's in the normal process.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Director Plumbeck. Thank you, Sarah. Any other questions? Director Colley.
So I'm just a little curious about the statement of overriding consideration. If an EIR accurately says that some project is going to trash the environment and is accurate and all the damage is going to be done, and a lead agency basically says, oh, we still think it's worth it, is it possible for a member of the public to challenge it to say that it's not worth it? Or is that the public agency's right to make that determination and the courts will not interfere with that generally?
So I think you've brought up the dividing line between CEQA and the statement of overriding consideration. The idea, and I'm quoting from a court case here, the idea of a CEQA is to, quote, rub the environmental impacts of a project in the faces of the elected decision makers, literally make them confront what the project will do. And then if they want to adopt a statement of overriding consideration to support their vote to approve the project, that's their role as the elected. And so sometimes that can be confusing that CEQA has both a procedural and an administrative and a legislative side. So the administrative is obviously complying with CEQA, preparing this document that discloses all these environmental impacts. Absolutely. But then the legislative side is saying, no, as a matter of policy, we, the electeds, are going to vote to do it anyway. And so, no, you can't ask a court to overturn a statement of override simply because they've decided to override an environmental impact so egregious. I think the remedy there, not to be facetious, the remedy there is election.
Thank you.
I missed what you said at the end, Sarah.
The remedy is to not reelect the people who voted for a project you did not like.
Director Ford.
Thank you, President Martin. I wanted to thank Director Armitage for asking for this primer on the CEQA, and Sarah did a job that is outstanding, and I think we're fortunate to have her as a resource for the questions we may have. The one thing I was just going, I have a question, but I was going to just point out a couple examples. Sometimes it's hard when you see a generic discussion of CEQA to relate to how it boils down to the agency. So for instance, responsible agency versus lead agency. When we acquired the Buena Vista Rosedale Rio Bravo water supply project, we were a lead agency. We had to ultimately make a statement of overriding considerations to approve the project. In the case of a responsible agency, it's a little more subtle, but one recent one we had is the annexation of Tesoro. The county approved all the entitlements for that particular project, and it eventually went through LAPCO as well too. But ultimately, in order to approve the annexation of that project into our service area, we were a responsible agency and we adopted the county's environmental documents and ultimately said that they complied with CEQA, and by that virtue, we comply with CEQA too. I was going to say that the statutory exemptions are nice because, as Sarah mentioned, they are somewhat bulletproof. And if you have a pipeline of less of a mile in length, we can say it's statutorily exempt from CEQA. If we put it through a wetland, we can still say it's statutorily exempt from CEQA, but we have to comply with other laws. On the other hand, a categorical exemption, you don't have that luxury. If we are expanding the plant here for some reason, putting in a parking lot, and there's a wetland, we can't use the categorical exemption that she mentioned about an expansion in the plant as being categorically exempt from CEQA. So there is both art and science to this, and she obviously knows it all quite well. And so with that, I just had one question, Sarah. Now that I've gone on a long stem winder here, this is with regard to the Irvine case mm-hmm. that you cite here and that we are using from time to time. This is something that we just had recently where we had a grant application. And I think it was discussed with council that that particular language could be used as part of our CEQA determination for the board. I'm just wondering, in the case where we have already in a sequence of decisions made an environmental determination, should we use that Irvine decision again in afterwards? In other words, we have a case where it's been determined that the project, we find it categorically exempt for some reason, a subsequent decision comes up, should we still use that or should we refer back to the original finding about the finding the project categorically exempt?
The latter. If you have conducted CEQA review of a project, whether it's by an exemption, an EGDAC, an EIR, whatever, that would be the CEQA for your grant application, because there you would have already evaluated the environmental impacts. The reason for that County of Orange decision was the court said nothing in their application expressed a commitment that limited their environmental review. But if you've actually already done your environmental review, then you have expressed your position and you do need to document that in your application.
So essentially what we're doing is saying that the subsequent decision, the CEQA finding that we made previously still applies.
And correct.
There's no changes in the project.
Yes.
That would cause a need for doing anything else. Okay, and then my last point was just that we talk a great deal. The day-to-day practice here is that, and it's probably true for most agencies with the possible exception of land use planning agencies, is that you probably prepare on the order of 40 or more exemptions for every initial study prepared, and probably, you know, a dozen negative declarations off of initial studies before you actually find the need to prepare an EIR. So EIRs, for the most part, are pretty rare critters relative to those other types of environmental documents or findings. And that's it. I just want to thank you, Sarah. It was an excellent job.
Thank you, Director Ford. I'm sure God, we have experts that can handle all this stuff. Director Armitage.
Thank you. Yes, I want to also say thank you to Ms. Osowitz. I hope I'm saying your name right.
Osowitz,
thank you. Director Ford is right. I was the one who asked for this, mainly for the benefit of the newer members, but hopefully everybody learned a little something. I will admit that it did feel a bit like drinking out of a fire hose, especially the first half of the piece of the presentation. I think those of you who've gotten to know me well know that I like to try to really deeply understand things. So I get frustrated when I can't understand it at first. So two questions for you. One is, I'm wondering if you have some other suggested resources for those of us who do want to continue learning about this to continue understanding more. And then second question is, who's the person for the agency who makes a determination about exemption status or which documents are required when in form of recommendation when it comes to committee and the board?
Well, let me take the first one and then I'm going to pass on the second one. But the first one is, there are a variety of sources. The Association of Environmental Professionals, I'm a member and I sit on their legislative advisory committee, gives a day-long workshop on CEQA once a year, which we can certainly alert you to. They also do a day-long advanced workshop and an intermediate workshop. So there are
those ways of training. There are treatises, but I don't see any reason why anyone needs to read a 300-page book. I think a workshop day may be better. There are, I believe UCLA has a CEQA training that is multi-hour. So we can prepare a list of multi-hour trainings. I will tell you, this was a cut down of a PowerPoint that I usually take an hour to give. And it, even then, it's a water hose. And I freely admit that. As to agency decisions, I am going to pass on that, except to say that even if an administrator, high-level administrator in any lead agency makes a CEQA decision, that can always be directed by the highest elected or the highest level decision-making body, that they can always direct a change in that decision, but typically it comes forward because of an administrator making a decision. So now I'm going to defer it back to the agency staff.
I can jump in. So it's kind of a iterative process generally on the different projects that we have. So, I think what we do as a staff is, since Director Ford's no longer on staff, we enlist the help of some professional consultants that give us advice on what types of things that we need to be looking at for CEQA review for our various projects. So a lot of the time, you know, if it's a clear-cut thing, like the example given of a pipeline that's shorter than a mile and don't think of the impact of that, probably don't need outside staff or resources, consultants to help us with that. But generally, we would run that through the process, and it, as you guys are well aware, and probably would spur the question of having the presentation, you see those actions come to the board in the action that you're usually taking on approving the project. It has a CEQA conclusion to it. A practice that we're adhering to is to run that by Sarah as well. If it's a more complicated, you know, consultant input staff review on a project that it's a little bit more complicated, we'll engage Sarah at that point as well to get her advice on, you know, what level she would think is necessary based on our description to her of the project. So it's really kind of an iterative process that involves the engineers. We in Water Resources have staff that are managing the consultants that we engage to give that input.
Are there any other questions from the board on the presentation? Seeing none, thank you again, Sarah, for the presentation. Thank you, BBK, for providing this to the agency. So we can.
Good night. Thank you for having me.
Very good. Move on to item 8, General Manager's Report on Activities, Projects, and Programs. Mr. Stone.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. President, and members of the board. Relatively short report tonight. Today we held our first in-person staff meeting, all staff meeting, I should say, since January of 2020. Now we've had all staff meetings, and again, Chris and his team of wizards made that possible through mega Zoom format. And you know, that was great, and it was certainly a welcome thing to be able to do that. But there's really nothing like having the chance to see each other, laugh and cheer together, eat pretty good breakfast burritos and fruit, and share some recent organizational accomplishments, staff service milestone awards. For some of the staff, it was their very first all staff meeting in person. And that includes some staff that have been here for, you know, up to two years. And we had them raise their hands, and it was kind of shocking. Like, raise your hands if you were hired after the pandemic started. So it's amazing what you can do. And it's amazing what they can do. And I think it's a credit to our staff that they've accomplished so much during the, not only the past several years, but the past 2 years. And we certainly tried to make that point and provided the news of the board's action on the COLA, which got some applause as well. In the service awards, to kind of look at the other end of the spectrum, we had the newer employees that had been hired in the pandemic. We had a number of service awards, and you know, normally the 30-year award would be the showstopper in a meeting like that, but we had two 35-year awards today as well. And that just always amazes me. It also always amazes me that they inevitably look younger than I do. So clearly I should have worked in operations because I would have started earlier. and whatever they do keeps them pretty healthy. So that's great. Just one other note tonight in response to the earlier public comment about the outstanding debt. I just note that we do report that in our quarterly financial that goes to the Finance and Administration Committee. And for reference, that number currently is $293 million. So it is a significant sum, but in reference to the overall equity of the agency, the cash on hand and the value of the assets that have been built, it is an appropriate amount of debt at the current time. And we try to evaluate that. I think we've had some fairly extensive discussions in the Finance Committee about the use of PAYGO, the basis for evaluating what's a reasonable amount of debt given the types and nature of facilities that we're financing. And of course, that's an ongoing policy discussion that the board has purview over. So the staff will continue to try to operate within the policy guidance of the board on that as we consider any future debt and also PAYGO amounts and paying down debt. That's it. Just wanted to highlight, I think it's a good question to be asking. But the implication that it's hidden is not the case. It's actually reported on a regular basis in a public document. And we can certainly point out where that is. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Stone. Are there any public comments on Mr. Stone's report, April?
There is not.
Are there any questions or discussion from the board on Mr. Stone's report? Thank you, Matt. All right, we can move on to item 9, President's Report. I have a number of things to update the board on tonight. Let me try to do this and still speak into the microphone. All right. Outside the agency conference events, we have the AQUA 2022 Spring Conference being held in Sacramento May 3 to May 5. We have the State of the County has been rescheduled unfortunately, during the Aqua Week at May 4th at 11:30 at the Hyatt Regency in Valencia. The 2022 Economic Outlook is scheduled now for September 9th at College of the Canyons Performing Arts Center. As of April 1st, 2022, all board and committee meetings will be hybrid. Upcoming regular and special board meetings in person at the Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant. All of the following regular and special board meetings will start at 6 p.m. There is a special board meeting on April 25th to conduct interviews for the Division 3 vacant position and select a candidate to fill that position. Handouts for this meeting will be posted and emailed to the public on Thursday or Friday and hand-delivered to each director along with the procedures for that evening's meeting. There will be a rescheduled special board meeting on April 26, which will replace the May 3rd regular board meeting, which will be canceled due to AQUA. The next regular board meeting will be held on May 17th at 6 p.m. There will be a special board meeting workshop on May 24th for the sustainability plan. This will be an interactive workshop. Upcoming hybrid committee meetings for now will all be held at the Rio Vista Water Treatment Building plant in the board and training room, which we are sitting in. The May 11th Water Resources Committee meeting, 5:30. The May 12th Rescheduled Engineering and Operations Committee meeting at 5:30. The May 16th Finance and Administration Committee meeting at 5:30. And the May 19th Public Outreach and Legislation Committee at 5:30. And that completes my report for this evening. Madam Secretary, do we have any public comment?
We do not.
We have any questions or follow-up from the board on the report? Seeing none, we can move to item 10, committee meeting recap reports for informational purposes only. Are there any public comments? By the way, there are, only one committee recap report in your folder, in your packet today, and that's the Engineering and Operations Committee meeting of April 7th. Are there any public comments on this, April?
There is not.
Are there any questions or discussion from the board on that one committee report? Seeing none, we can move to AB 1234 reports. There were several AB 1234 reports that were included in your packet. One additional report was posted to the website and emailed. I appreciate those that submit their reports ahead of time. Do we have any additional AB 1234 reports tonight from the board? Director Ozahosky, you got your hand on the buzzer first.
All right. I had the pleasure of having my one-on-one meeting with the general manager, Matt Stone. Very, very productive meeting. We spoke about attrition, retention, potential cooperation with the fire department vis-a-vis our storage water tanks. And I found it very productive and short and sweet. I believe we made it within an hour, Mr. Stone. So it's always a good thing. And April, that was yesterday from 10 to 11.
Thank you.
That's it for me. Back to you, President Mark.
Thank you, Director Ozahosky. Director Cooper, you had your hand up.
Thank you, President Martin. Today I attended Aqua meeting in Sacramento, working on developing the strategic plan for the next few years for Aqua. On April 6th, I had a Region 8 member meeting with the chair to work on the program for Region 8 for this coming year. And that's it.
President
Thank
Cooper,
you, Director
or
Cooper.
Director Cooper, was that virtual or in person? Thank you.
Director Planbeck.
Are we supposed to be reporting our meetings with the general manager? They're not just considered like board meetings. We have to report them as AB 1234.
I'm not sure I caught all that.
Okay. Are we supposed to be reporting our meetings with the general manager that they're not just like board meetings? Yeah. They're extra.
You do need to report on your one-on-ones with the general manager.
Okay, well, I had a one-on-one with the general manager in April. I will have to send you the date because I don't recall it, but I very much appreciated the discussion we had.
Very good. Thank you, Director Planbeck. Are there any other AB 1234s tonight? Looking around, Director Ozahosky.
President Martin, I had a question regarding item 11.3, your report regarding the Delta conveyance design and construction. Regarding the 29 holes drilled and sampled, the first batch of the overall exploration program in for this year, there's not going to be issues with those holes, right?
Well, they just started mobilizing to do those 29 holes, so they haven't, there's no results yet. They had to go through a whole court process to obtain permission to get on the property to make the do the test. So
okay, but green light.
I will report when I get the information about that. Certainly will bring it back.
Excellent, thank you.
Sure. All right. Any other AB 1234s? Seeing none, we can move to. Well, we actually have canceled deleted items 12 and 13. There's been no closed session and no closed session announcements. We move to item 14, requests for future agenda items. Are there any requests? Director Colley.
Yeah, my I think I've suggested this before, but this public comment kind of brings it back. And there's the public comment that we received this written letter to the board, basically putting together their concerns with the short-term water shortage and long-term approval of projects and saying there's water available. I've suggested, I think, in the past that it might be appropriate to agendize something very similar to tonight's CEQA briefing on our legal and ethical obligations as it relates to approval of projects and the water supply for projects and things like that. We don't actually approve projects. I mean, there's a lot to that. And I think a 20-minute, half-hour presentation, perhaps led by legal staff, would be, I think, of value because this is a comment that comes up in public discourse very frequently, and I think is a common misunderstanding amongst the public. And so I think even on this board, we have some value in reminding ourselves of what our obligations are.
Are you suggesting both these water supply assessment and the water supply verification steps?
Yes, and as those relate to our obligation to find water, the conflating these is these two issues: the short-term water shortage and approval of water supply assessments are oftentimes conflated in the public mind, I think, and perhaps some on this board to some extent. And I think it'd be appropriate to have legal counsel provide us some thoughts on to what extent they should be conflated and what our obligations are. So I'd like to see that as sort of
Thank you, Director Colley. Are there any other requests for future agenda?
Oh, down here. Director Ozdahansky.
Okay, I just have one item. I would like to hear an update from Mr. Chris Perez on the status of replacement and positioning of our new security cameras on our properties and buildings, and if the LA County Sheriff's Department Crime Prevention Unit has provided any helpful direction in their placement. And I would like to recommend for this briefing to be during closed session.
Director Kelly.
Usually on the agenda, there's a section for director reports, and I noticed that's missing today. But I would just like to offer my apologies to the board and to the public for being late today. As great of a job that our illustrious Secretary April Jacobs does at herding cats into this meeting, regretfully with a hectic tax season, I missed the notes, and I want to apologize sincerely to everybody here.
Well, we appreciate that you made the effort to get here, Director Kelly. All right, Director Armitage.
Thank you. So as you know, a couple of weeks ago, Director Bronstein and I attended the Special Districts Leadership Academy, and one of the key points from the 2.5 days of training was that it's important for board members to understand the agency's strategic plan and to be updated on progress towards the goals and objectives that are listed in the strategic plan. So I would like to ask for a presentation made on overview of the strategic plan and where we are in progress towards those goals and objectives. And then secondly, I've had someone reach out to me expressing concern about the fact that when members of the public submit written comment, that some of them may not be aware that their personal contact information, so emails and home address, are being put onto the website, which is available for anybody and everybody to see. So I understand the concern, and I agree that people may not be aware that information is being shared publicly. So I try to get a sense of, is this the norm? So I looked at some other websites to see what other water agencies are doing with their written public comment. And it seems to be that it's handled in many, many different ways. So I don't think there's a standard. but none of the other agencies that I looked at had their public comment posted on their website directly. And it seems to be there's a number of ways people can submit their public comment. Anyhow, I would like to see a reassessment of maybe the legal issues around that, and perhaps a way we can maybe better protect public's contact information so that it is not posted for everybody to see. Perhaps that could be blocking out their emails and their home addresses before it gets posted to the website. I mean, I think it's actually a good thing to post public comment because it increases transparency. So I'm not necessarily against that. But if we could perhaps block out their contact information, I think that would be a good thing. And perhaps adding a line into the agenda that states that if you do submit public comment, that at least your name and the comment will be shared publicly so that people are aware. Thank you.
Excuse me. Thank you, Director Armitage. Are there any other requests for future agenda items? Looking down the road, looking over here. I don't see any. Do we have any public comment, April?
We do not.
All right, with that, we've reached item 15, adjournment. And I want to thank everyone for their participation. And we look at the clock. We are adjourning before the 9 o'clock, the new witching hour that we've adopted with our 6 o'clock start time. So I appreciate everybody's attendance and have a good evening. We are adjourned.